It's not every day that the world makes a big deal out of a phone call, but then it's not every day that our president spends a few minutes on the phone chatting through interpreters with the newly installed president of Iran. In fact, when it happened in late September, it was the first time since the late 1970s such a conversation had taken place. One phone call does not build a relationship, but it certainly can signal a potential stress, potential change in what has been a frosty standoff for decades. Where can and will the American-Iranian relation go from here? We have a couple of people who have been watching Iran for a long time with us. Barbara Slavin is a senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council. She joins us by phone. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you.
Have I got your last name correct?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
Phew, okay. Jamal Abdeeb is with us as well. He's the policy director at the National American-Iranian Council. Jamal, thank you and welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a bit about your organization's intern. And Jamal, let's start with you about the National American-Iranian Council.
Yeah, sorry, National Iranian-American Council.
Oops, I did get that backwards.
Yeah, it happens. So we're a national organization. We're a grassroots organization. We're the largest Iranian-American grassroots group. We work here in D.C. to educate lawmakers and officials about sort of what the concerns are of the Iranian-American community. And we've been around for 11 years. We were formed in 2002, around the time that there was talk of the Axis of Evil and possible invasions of Iran after Iraq was over with. And really, you know, our mission has been to empower Iranian-Americans so they can be a part of those policy discussions and involved in crafting policies that affect both themselves and also that affect Iran, because we feel like we have a lot to add to that conversation.
I know there are parts of the country that do have significant Iranian-American communities. What is approximately, if anybody has a hard figure in this, the total number of Iranian-Americans living in the United States at the moment?
The approximate number is probably about 1.5 million. It's hard to get a definitive number, but that's what the estimate is based on some of the census data and other data points that we have.
I know there's a big Iranian-American community in the Los Angeles area. Is that the largest of them? Are most of them there, or are they scattered around the country?
Yeah, Los Angeles is actually the largest. It's referred to as Tehrangeles by some people, and that is I've heard some people say that there's actually the highest number of Iranian diaspora in L.A. Of any city in the world outside of Iran.
All right. We'll take up more about the work of the National Iranian American Council in just a few minutes. Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council. I heard one of your partners on the Diane Rehm show this morning from the South Asia Center as well. Tell us about the South Asia Center and its work and the larger work of the Atlantic Council.
Sure. Well, the Atlantic Council, we like to say, is a 50-year-old startup. It was founded in 1961 to promote U.S.-Europe cooperation under the rubric of NATO, but it's expanded with NATO out of area, and there are now 10 regional centers that focus on everything from Turkey and Eurasia, South Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, you name it. So it's expanded enormously in the last 5-6 years. I'm attached to the South Asia Center, but I direct an Iran task force at the Atlantic Council. And I guess the reason I'm with South Asia is because we didn't have the Middle East Center at the time that I joined the Atlantic Council. But in many ways it makes sense, because Iran has very strong cultural, linguistic ties to Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. So it's a good place to be.
And what is the task force set up to do? What are the aims of the task force?
Well, we try to educate the public and the policy community about Iran, about U.S. policies toward Iran, and we're looking for pragmatic solutions to the problems that we have with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So we've put out, I don't know, something like 24 different papers and reports with policy recommendations. We hold various meetings. Some are public, some are off the record. I went and met with the Iranian foreign minister with a couple of my colleagues when he was in New York for the UN General Assembly, and I also met with the new head of the Iranian Central Bank and Iran's new economics and finance minister just recently when they were in Washington for the World Bank IMF meetings. So we try to learn as much as we can, and we try to educate folks.
The Iranian foreign minister you met with for the United Nations meetings, is this a new foreign minister? Help us understand how much of Iran's upper structure changed with the election of Hassan Rouhani.
Well, the way I put it is that this particular crowd is getting a chance to have a do-over. It's the same group of individuals who were in charge of Iranian foreign policy when Mohammad Khatami was the president back from 1997 to 2005, before Mahmoud Ahmadinejad came in. And even though Iran has a supreme leader, a Muslim cleric named Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has not changed, it's very important who the president is and who his team is, particularly in national security, because they do have an influence over Iranian policies. When Khatami was president, he was trying to achieve some sort of rapprochement with the West and with the United States. It didn't work out for a number of reasons. I wrote a book about this a couple years ago called Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, and certainly the George W. Bush administration and the Axis of Evil speech and all of that had something to do with ruining the chances, I think, for rapprochement back then. But it's the same group. So we have Hassan Rouhani, the president. He was Iran's national security advisor back under Khatami. He's now the president, and his foreign minister is Mohammad Javad Zarif, who was Iran's deputy foreign minister and then Iran's ambassador to the United Nations at a very pivotal moment. They're very experienced. They speak English. And I think that this is our second chance. It's another bite at the apple for us and also for them.
Much more to talk about the prospects for future relations between Iran and the United States and Iran and the world at large. We're talking to Barbara Slavin from the Atlantic Council and Jamal Abdeeb from the National Iranian American Council. You can join our conversation on the Exchange as well. Back with our guests and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. The Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Iran and its relations with the rest of the world, which look like they could be going through a bit of a thaw with Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, in place and some of the senior leadership changing with him as well. We're talking to Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council, and Jamal Abdeeb, who's policy director of the National Iranian American Council. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is here, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So each of you in turn, I want to talk about what is the difference between Hassan Rouhani and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Is it that Rouhani is potentially that much more moderate, or is he just less brash than Ahmadinejad? In other words, would anybody look good by comparison? Jamal Abdeeb?
Yeah, well, most people would look good in comparison to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. That is not a high standard to set. But that being said, Rouhani does represent a significant departure from Ahmadinejad's positions. And I think the way Barbara put it was perfect, that this is actually a return of a group that was in charge of the presidency previously under Khatami. Now, the major break in terms of what has been the focus for most people here in the U.S. who have been hearing a lot about the nuclear issue over the past decade is Rouhani's position on nuclear negotiations. Rouhani comes from a camp that espoused the view that the nuclear issue could be resolved through compromise, that through negotiations, Iran could give up significant enough compromises, enough assurances to the West in order to resolve the issue. When Rouhani was the nuclear negotiator, he temporarily suspended Iran's enrichment program, which was a significant concession, and he offered to cap the number of centrifuges spinning and you know, producing nuclear materials. This is a deal that back in 2003 and later in 2005, the West, the U.S., Europe, we ended up rejecting, but which now is something that I think we could accept. We realize that this is actually very attractive. This is something that could limit Iran's nuclear program to purely civilian purposes. But what happened back in 2003 and then in 2005 is that we rejected it,
Why?
Thanks in part to, the Bush administration's view was that Iran could not have any enrichment program whatsoever. And so there was a sort of maximalist view, this precondition that Iran could not have any domestic enrichment capability. Now, because that was rejected, Rouhani really was left out on a limb. He had convinced the Supreme Leader to suspend the enrichment program, which Iran views as their right. They're signatories to the Nonproliferation Treaty. They think that they have the right to have a domestic enrichment capability. When he wasn't able to show the Supreme Leader and others in the Iranian political establishment that this compromise path could actually yield results, he was basically shut out of the political system. And this, in part, led to Ahmadinejad's rise, because Ahmadinejad said, look, these guys are traitors, they're wimps, they're willing to give up the whole shop, and I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to pursue a path of resistance. I'm not going to play nice with the West, and that is how Iran is going to protect its nuclear rights. We have found over the past eight years that that has not been a successful strategy for Iran, and now Rouhani basically has a second shot to say, look, this compromise path is the right path. The West is willing to negotiate with us. This isn't about regime change or making Iran weak. This is just about getting a deal that both sides can agree to. And because of that, Rouhani only has a short period of time that he can actually show that, unlike the previous time he attempted this, this time compromise can work.
Is there any concern, though, that the response from within Iran will be, hey, wait, you're giving away the farm. You're moving too fast.
That is definitely a major concern. But what it looks like so far is that, almost to a surprising degree, the Iranian political establishment has lined up behind Rouhani. And this was largely because the Supreme Leader said, okay, this guy, he won this overwhelming election. We need to line up behind him and give him a shot to try this. And because of that, all of the other sort of hardline elements have fallen in line. But this is a precarious alignment. As soon as it appears that, you know, sanctions relief isn't possible, that, you know, the West will never allow for Iran to have any kind of enrichment program, if that appears to be what happens, the minute that happens, I think that the hardliners are going to turn around and say, told you so.
Barbara Slavin at the South Asia Center, the Atlantic Council, is there a real need in terms of speed and deliberation as well? I mean, Jamal talks about a limited window here, but so there's obviously some desire to move quickly on this. But also, there need to be elements pleased, it seems, in both countries to make sure that you're not moving too fast. Because even after the phone call on September 27th or 26th, there were people saying, oh, boy, Obama's going to get rolled by Rouhani. What's the view from you at the South Asia Center about speed versus deliberation here?
Yeah, well, I think everybody would love to have a solution quickly. The Iranians have been talking about a deal within a year with several stages, the U.S. as well. I think the most important thing, frankly, is that these negotiations that started in Geneva continue, that they're productive, that perhaps there's some agreement on some confidence-building measures, and we get used to dealing with the Iranians directly again. It's, you know, the 30-minute or the 15-minute phone call was great, but what's really important is that Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, talked for a half an hour one-on-one with John Kerry, our Secretary of State, in New York. There was another one-on-one bilateral between the Americans and the Iranians in Geneva, and I assume there will continue to be these kinds of direct talks, and that's what we really need to start working out some sort of compromise. You know, there are hardliners on both sides that are ready to pounce, and Congress is certainly not going to make it easy for Obama. They're not only not going to lift sanctions, they're going to try to impose new ones probably as this goes forward. So, I mean, in that sense, there is the pressure of time, that there is an impatience on both sides if it doesn't look as though we can come to some sort of compromise.
Oops, she got off the line. I was going to take a call from Nicole in Ashland, but she's not there anymore. We have an email from Rick in Eureka. He writes, a while ago I heard an interesting quote from an Iranian man on the street in Tehran. The statute of limitations for the U.S. to be angry about 1979 has run out. The statute of limitations for Iranians to be angry about 1953 has run out as well. Obviously talking about the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh and putting the Shah back on the throne in Iran. Barbara Slavin, what do you think about that statement, though? The statute of limitations running out in anger.
Yeah, I've been to Iran 9 times since 1996. My last visit was in August. And, if they took an accurate poll, I think they did actually some years back, and something like 70% of the Iranian population would like to have normal diplomatic relations with the United States. This is a political dispute. It's not a dispute between peoples anymore. As you pointed out, it's been a long time since Mossadegh. It's been a long time since the Islamic Revolution. The question is, how do you choreograph it in such a way that neither side loses too much face? And that's part of what this is about. We have the nuclear question. If we can reach some accommodation there, that's going to go a long way, I think, toward bringing about some kind of detente and eventually a restoration of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran. It hurts both our countries that we don't have this relationship. It gives undue influence to others in the region who don't have our best interests at heart sometimes. I mean, it puts us in a position where we have to rely on Saudi Arabia. You know, the Saudis are furious at us because we haven't invaded Syria and we haven't bombed Iran. I'm sorry, but that may not be in the best interest of the United States, even if the Saudis would like to see it. I frankly doubt it would be in the best interest of Saudi Arabia either. But we need to have more freedom of maneuver in foreign policy, and that means having a different relationship with the Iranians. And the Iranians need to have options beyond relying on China for most of their trade now. They've isolated themselves because of this nuclear program. So I think there's a beginning of a realization on both sides that this relationship has to change.
We're talking about relationships with Iran, both from the United States and the rest of the world community, with Barbara Slavin at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council, where she's a senior fellow. Jamal Abdeeb is with us as well. He's the policy director of the National Iranian American Council. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to run that email past you, Jamal, and get the lens of the Iranian-American perspective on that statement about the statute of limitations for the U.S. to be angry about 1979 has run out. The statute of limitations for Iran to be angry about 1953 has run out. What's the lens that the Americanness of the Iranian-American community puts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, the statute of limitations on past grievances. I think that this is something that for Iranian Americans, as well as for, you know, the governments of the U.S. and Iran, these past grievances really do haunt this potential relationship. You know, Iranian Americans, largely, overwhelmingly, 99%, I think, according to the last poll, oppose a war with Iran. And a majority, somewhere around 60%, more than 60%, think that the best approach towards Iran is to engage in these direct negotiations. The Iranian Americans also overwhelmingly oppose broad sanctions. They support targeted sanctions and hope that there's more that can be done on human rights. But I got to say, you know, for Iranian Americans, I think that there's a bit of a difference between first generation and second generation. A lot of the community that first came from Iran, they did so either right before the revolution or after the revolution during the Iran-Iraq war, and, you know, don't necessarily have positive views of the Iranian government, not at all. And the same goes for second generation, but it's difficult for people who felt that they had to leave their country under some level of duress to feel that it would be, you know, that the Islamic Republic is a government that can never be accepted. So this is something that makes it very difficult to have these negotiations. But I think it's something that Iranian Americans, you know, view as being necessary in order to prevent a war. And I think a lot of people, they're, you know, we're seeing what is happening to our family and our friends in Iran as a result of this standoff. We see that the Iranian government is committing, you know, all kinds of human rights abuses, putting people in jail because of their political views, you know, harassing people, you know, kind of randomly if they're not, you know, dressed appropriately, and these things. And so they see the pressure that the Iranian government puts on ordinary Iranians. At the same time, they're seeing that the sanctions and the standoff with the U.S. is also putting pressure on ordinary Iranians, also putting pressure on our friends and family. And so they see people in Iran being squeezed by these two forces. And by and large, we don't want to see this happen. We want to see ordinary people able to live their lives. And if this standoff is resolved, you know, it's my organization's view that that is the best cure for addressing the human rights issue because Iranians will have more space to operate. There will be less of a securitized environment in Iran that is the excuse for it is the standoff with the West. If the sanctions can be lifted, that frees up maneuverability for civil society to be less isolated. So really the bottom line is I think nobody is supportive necessarily of the Iranian government, but we think that there has to be a resolution of this standoff with the West in order for the concerns with the Iranian government to truly be resolved.
Is there a real does the generational difference get really acute, sort of like it does with Cuban Americans, in the sense that there could be no negotiations whatsoever with the Castro government for the Cuban Americans? Is there a lot of that feeling about the Iranian regime among Iranian Americans?
I don't think it's as it's not as large of a segment of Iranian Americans who feel that way. I think I don't think it's as entrenched that we can't negotiate with Iran. I think, you know, as I said, most Iranian Americans believe that we should have these negotiations, and I think the generational thing is more that I look at the sort of the organized groups of Iranian Americans, and you have a very small minority of Iranian Americans who perhaps have positive views of the Shah. Or are affiliated with other sort of opposition groups, but it's a very tiny tiny minority. But those were the groups, those first-generation groups, that were actually organized when they came to the U.S., and so they have had sort of an outsized voice in the community. In the last, 10, 15 years or so, this has changed, and sort of the folks who came here and didn't really want to get involved in politics, the first-generation folks, as well as sort of my generation, the second generation, who is willing to sort of get involved with politics and put some of these past grievances on hold so that we can resolve the problems of the moment, I think they're finally starting to make their voices heard and representing this majority view that, look, we don't have to support the Iranian government in order to support diplomacy with the Iranian government to resolve our concerns with that government.
Let us take a call for Jamal Abdeeb and Barbara Slavin. Here is Mark in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about normalizing relations with Iran.
Yeah, good morning. I guess from a global perspective, I think the Iranian people are really caught in the middle of a global, what I would call a military-industrial complex profit machine where the players that support Iran, like Russia and China, on one side, and the U.S. government that opposes Iran, calls it a state sponsor of terror, that in fact these countries, Iran, Russia, and the U.S., have actually set up a global game where they play both sides of these alleged conflicts, meaning the nuclear program of Iran and how it might or might not be a threat. Because if you look at the business relationships between our countries and the multinationals based in our countries, meaning Russia, China, and the U.S., they're very close. They're partners, really, in a global scheme. And a large part of that global economy is the military-industrial complex. And unfortunately, the Iranian people are stuck in the middle while these fascist leaders of these countries put the Iranian people in the middle. And it's just all for profit. But you can find links to facts and congressional hearings that back up what I'm saying at standupforyourrights.me. In a post about human rights abuse in China. So I'd ask you to check that out. It's criminal. It's really sad what's being done to the Iranian people. So.
All right, Mark, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Barbara, can you give us some perspective on what Mark's talking about?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I entirely followed his argument. I mean, obviously, there are companies that make money off conflict, and I would say that the U.S. Defense industry has done very well off this sort of anti-Persian racism and paranoia, particularly of the Arabs who live on the other side of the Persian Gulf, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Emiratis, and so on, who are buying gobs and gobs of American military equipment to defend against the Persian threat, the alleged Persian threat. No, I think the Iranian people have they've had a really raw deal. They had a revolution against the Shah, and they wound up with a regime that was in many ways much more oppressive than the Shah's regime, at least in terms of personal freedoms. And people, over the years that I've been going there have been have become thoroughly fed up with many aspects of the system. But that said, they're still patriotic Iranians, and this is where the nuclear issue comes back in, because a lot of people may not support the government, but they do think that Iran has every much as right to, the right to have nuclear technology as other countries in the region, including Pakistan, which is next door, including Russia, including Israel. So, you know, you have to deal with that as well.
Much more to talk about Iran and relations with the rest of the world with Barbara Slavin and Jamal Abdi. We'll come back with them and take your phone calls as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Iran and its relations with the rest of the world and the prospects for improving those with the new President Hassan Rouhani and other senior leaders in the Iran regime. Our guests are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council, and Jamal Abdib, who's the Policy Director at the National Iranian American Council. You can join us on the exchange. Our phone number anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Barbara Slavin, you mentioned the nuclear question again just a moment ago. That really is the big one that needs to be resolved, it would seem. How much information do we truly have, though? Because it seems like there has been both an effort to overstate, for political reasons in America, what's going on there, a desire certainly by the Iranians to understate what they are doing and what their purposes are. Do we really know what the truth is about what the capability is and how soon it might actually turn into the potential for weapons capability?
Actually, we know a great deal, and that's because the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the UN nuclear watchdog, is in Iran every single day of the year, 365 days of a year. There are inspectors from the IAEA in Iran looking at all of their declared nuclear facilities, and that includes the places where they're enriching uranium. They have inspectors there on average once a week. Now, could Iran be hiding certain sites? Could they be doing some research? It's possible they could be doing some work on a small scale that hasn't been detected. But it looks as though we have a pretty good grip on what they're about, and they have made substantial progress. They have a lot of enriched uranium, enriched up to 20% of the isotope U-235, which is pretty close to weapons-grade uranium. They have made progress on their missiles. What we don't know is whether they actually know how to make a warhead that they could stick on top of a missile. They claim that they're not after nuclear weapons, but they have pretty much all the building blocks that you need in order to get there. So, you know, this is a question. Can we induce them not to take the final steps, and how do we do it? Is it through a combination of sanctions and incentives? Is it through military action? These are the sorts of things that the Obama administration and the Israelis, who we haven't mentioned up till now, have been confronting over the last couple of years.
How difficult do the Israelis make the process, since it seems they hold a much harder line than the American government does?
Well, you know, you could say that they're playing a useful role in terms of being the sort of bad cop here. The pressure that they have put, particularly on the U.S. Congress, but also on the Europeans, is one of the reasons that we have these very draconian economic sanctions that have made it very hard for Iran to sell oil and to get access to the money that it earns for selling that oil. It's been very effective. But my sense is that this whole pressure campaign by the Israelis may be reaching a moment of diminishing returns, because there does seem to be a genuine desire now on the part of both the United States and the Iranians to reach a deal. And if the Israelis come off looking as though they oppose any deal that does not meet all of their conditions, they could lose some influence in this.
And Jamal Abdib at the National Iranian American Council, does your organization have a position on what is the appropriate level of nuclear energy activity in Iran?
Our view is that there has to be a you know, a verifiable deal that basically can provide assurances that Iran is not able to build a nuclear weapon, to break out and build a nuclear weapon. I think this is hopefully the position of the Obama administration. It's I think the most realistic solution. Some of the maximalism that I discussed earlier about, you know, zero enrichment is just completely unworkable. And I think an important point, sort of to add to what Barbara just said, is, you know, no country has built a nuclear weapon under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is a signatory to this treaty. They have inspectors on the ground. No other country has managed to build a weapon while they were under that treaty. So this is a very powerful tool that is in place to ensure Iran doesn't build a nuclear weapon. And what we need to be focused on is strengthening the provisions of the treaty to which Iran is bound, to make sure that we have enough inspector access to ensure that Iran can't break out. I think what is possible right now is potentially to have Iran sign on to the additional protocol and to allow for even more complete access to all of their nuclear facilities, spot inspections of all the facilities, things of this nature, to basically provide assurance that, yes, they are enriching, but no, they can't enrich up to weapons grade and then develop a warhead and do all these things that would be problematic. This is a workable solution, but I'm very concerned that once again, there's this maximalist view that is cropping up. We're seeing it now, senators and certain hawkish editorial boards are putting forward this position that the only acceptable solution is if Iran completely dismantles its program. Now, it'd be fine. You know, that's a fine goal to have, but it's completely unrealistic, and it's not necessary in order to ensure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. So we can't make the perfect the enemy of the good and insist on this unreasonable condition.
Let us take a call. We have Brad in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Iran with Jamal Abdeeb and Barbara Slavin.
Yes, I wonder whether the United States is now the attack dog for Saudi Arabia. They want us to do this and that. I'm so tired of our country, like, pounding the drums of war and then attacking largely innocent people, decimating their societies, and then moving on. However, when we're done, we do end up creating good relations, family connections, business association, people in Vietnam, Germany, Japan, and so forth. I wish we could move right to the friendly relations with the Iranians without having to go through the war stage. I don't want the war. I don't know anyone in our society who wants to create war with the Iranians. We're obsessing over their possibly making one nuclear weapon while the Israelis have hundreds of them and Pakistanis have hundreds of them. I wish we could create human relations so that we don't demonize and objectify these decent people, so we can have friendly relations, family connections, business associations, and so forth. Move right to the good thing. This is a promising, hopeful moment, and I'm so glad we have President Obama as our president and other rational voices that are helping to steer it this way.
All right, Brad, thanks for the thoughts. Appreciate that. Barbara Slavin, what happens, you think, in the next few weeks to months with the United States and Iran? Is the United States going to be Iran's focus? I mean, does everything have to come through the United States, or are there other players on the world stage who might be able to be good intermediaries?
Well, certainly there are other players. The United States is negotiating with Iran with the company of the other permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. But I think really this has always been to a large extent about the U.S. and Iran, because the United States, apart from Israel, has taken the hardest line against the Iranian nuclear program. France under Sarkozy was pretty tough as well. I'm not sure they're quite as tough now under Hollande. But it really is about us and them. And to your caller, I think we can absolutely avoid the military phase in this. In the next few months, we will see whether a deal is possible. The Iranians have sent their A-team, their best negotiators. We have a very good team as well, people who are experienced at this. And I think we'll know by the end of the year whether we can reach a deal.
Rick in Eureka writes an email. He says, John McCain's constituents, as well as those of the other hawks in Congress, need to let them know that armed conflict is not the answer. In that respect, it is very much a conflict between people, not governments. And that, again, from Rick in Eureka. Jamal Abdeeb, how hopeful are you that we can listen to the people in Congress who are the more level-headed voices, the non-war voices? Let's put it that way.
How confident am I that they will prevail?
Yes.
You know, this is still very much in play. I think that the next key decision is going to be on this question of sanctions. You've had, for the past several months, a push for yet another round of sanctions. This would be, you know, every single year for the past 5 years, Congress has passed at least one sanction bill. They haven't been able to pass a budget, or, you know, they're shutting the government down, but they've managed to pass Iran sanctions. And so there's a bill that's potentially queued up in the Senate. I think if it goes forward, it would be devastating to the diplomatic process. Now, that bill has been delayed, and if some of the moderate voices in the Senate can continue to keep that bill from getting to the floor, you know, I think that we can have enough time for diplomacy to actually work. But we also know that the hawks and the hardliners, they are pushing, they are demanding that this goes forward. And if they win, it would be, as I said, it would be really bad. I think that the situation on the ground for the first time, you know, the fact that Obama and Rouhani had this phone call, the fact that Rouhani has really been saying all the right things, it has changed the dynamics in Congress. But whether or not it changes it enough to hold off on sanctions, you know, it depends on whether I think people can equate these potentially bad short-term moves with the bigger picture that this would create a war. If we do new sanctions, this could upend diplomacy, and then, you know, what options are we left with? The option that everybody has said is on the table, this military option. So instead of playing games and saying, oh, well, we just want to do another sanctions bill, but we support diplomacy, you know, I think that it's important for constituents of these members of Congress and these senators to make it clear, look, if you support diplomacy, that doesn't mean just, you know, saying you don't like war. It means actually taking action, or in this case, not taking action and preventing new sanctions from going forward.
Many more events to come. Most of us will be watching the news closely to see what happens with Iran and its relations with the rest of the world. Jamal Abdeeb is the policy director at the National Iranian American Council. Thank you, Jamal. Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council. Thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.